Good afternoon. My name is Carol Sinclair, and I'm a psychologist. I'm employed by the Hinks Delcrest Treatment Center in Toronto, which is a children's mental health center. I'm also chair of the Canadian Psychological Association Committee on Ethics. And this afternoon, you're going to need to remember everything Dr. Barnett has told you, because you'll see just how we dealt with some of those issues when we developed our draft guidelines, which have been being drafted since 1999, so it's taking us a long time. I also have no conflict to disclose, conflict of interest to disclose. Everything that's done with the Canadian Psychological Association is done on a voluntary basis. I'm going to very briefly tell you a bit about the Canadian Psychological Association, and you'll see that the website address is there. Both the Code of Ethics that I'll be talking about and our draft guidelines are available online from that website. I'm also going to give you an overview of our Canadian Code of Ethics for psychologists, primarily because our guidelines are not standalone guidelines. Psychologists are informed that they must be used in conjunction with the code. I'm then going to give you some background and history on the development of the current draft guidelines, which are called Ethical Guidelines for Psychologists Providing Psychological Services via Electronic Media, and then give you an overview of the content of the guidelines. Then I'll explain why we still have not formally adopted these guidelines, the concerns that have been raised, current status, and the change process. It's definitely a work in progress. First of all, the National Association of Psychologists was founded in 1939. It is voluntary, not regulatory in nature. Just to explain that to those of you who are not from North America, in North America, each province and each state has its own regulatory body, and it's they're legally mandated. It is their job to protect the public. And it is the regulatory body that licenses psychologists to practice in that particular province or state and adjudicates complaints from members of the public in the jurisdiction. Now, this brings to us some issues that you may not be familiar with in your own country if you are not from North America. One of the objectives of the Canadian Psychological Association is to promote excellence in psychological research, education, and practice, including excellence in ethical behavior. And the method for doing this was the articulation of ethical principles, values, and standards in the Canadian Code of Ethics for Psychologists. This code was first adopted by CPA in 1986. It's been through two revisions, one in 1991, another in 2000, and there'll be another one within the next 2 years. Prior to 1986, Canadian psychology had used the APA Code of Ethics, which I don't think was unusual at that time, and I think it still is used outside of the APA in some countries. However, the CPA code has been accepted within Canada as the ethics code for Canadian psychologists, accepted by provincial regulatory and voluntary psychology organizations. Most have formally adopted or endorsed it, but it is used across the country. And by the way, that code needed to be individually considered and formally adopted or endorsed by every organization. CPA does not have the power or the authority to impose it. The code is a little bit different in its organization from many codes of ethics. It is organized around four ethical principles. respect for the dignity of persons, responsible caring, integrity in relationships, and responsibility to society. And each of the four sections has a value statement that defines the ethical principle. And this statement is followed by a set of standards related to the ethical principle. And each set of standards is grouped around key values concepts. And the code contains about 100 different standards organized in this way. Now, just to give you an idea of what is contained, and remember that this code is designed to be used in any kind of activity that psychologists are involved in. Some of the standards are specifically mentioned research, for instance, or teaching, but most of the standards are very generic and are intended to be applied to any kind of activity. And that would include psychological services online. So there are, these are just the topics about which there are standards. The code already has several statements around general respect and general rights, non-discrimination and acting to undo discrimination when you can. There are several standards around fair treatment and due process. And there are many standards around informed consent and freedom of consent. It's probably the largest section that we have in the code. We also have protection for vulnerable persons, those who cannot decide fully on their own, and also quite a number of standards about privacy and confidentiality. The second ethical principle, responsible caring, is primarily about being of benefit and not doing harm. So there are several standards around general caring, that it's very important that we act in a way that is of benefit and we are very careful to avoid harm. Also competence in self-knowledge, that in order to be of benefit and avoid harm, we need to be competent in what it is we are doing. Risk-benefit analysis, how important that is to do, not just for provision of services, but also in research and also in teaching. There are several standards around maximizing benefit, basically good practice, including use of evidence-based methods when such is available, and also minimizing harm, including the responsibility of offsetting and correcting harm. And that is because we have a number of psychologists who do research with animals, we also have a set of standards around care of animals in that in that particular principle. The third principle is integrity in relationships. And here we deal with some very basic issues around accuracy and honesty, the importance of being objective and avoiding bias, being straightforward and open in our communication with others, avoiding incomplete disclosure, sometimes called deception. That's standards, in fact, say no deception and no avoidance of incomplete disclosure in applied services. This would only exist in certain forms of social psychology research. Avoidance of conflict of interest, including things like dual relationships, and reliance, what we call reliance on the discipline. In other words, if you claim yourself to be a psychologist, you need to be aware of the rules and regulations of your discipline and follow them. And then our last principle is responsibility to society. And in here we have standards relating to the ethical duty, in a sense, to help develop knowledge for the benefit of humankind. We have several things which we call beneficial activities, which include accountability processes, helping to train the next generation of professionals, and so on. Respect for society, which includes respect for democratically accepted law. And also development of society, our participation and contribution to the ongoing development of our society. So that gives you sort of an overview, and there are many standards. And what we say is that looking at the second bullet point there, it is intended to guide psychologists, whether they're scientists, practitioners, or scientist practitioners, in any role, which includes research, direct service, being a manager, a supervisor, or a student, and whether the activity is related to a well-established area of activity or to a new evolving area. In addition to the standards themselves, we also provide in the code an ethical decision-making model to aid in the application to ethical dilemmas. However, we also recognize, and the code itself states this, that the principles and values of the code could be used to develop more detailed standards regarding specific ethical issues or types of activity. So there may be an identified need to come up with something that's more specific, and this code can be used as a framework for developing those standards. Several such guidelines have been developed by CPA, including use of animals in research, we have something much more specific, non-discriminatory practice, recovered memories, that was an issue a while back, services to women, which is more recent, and also supervision, that's a very recent document. Now, most guidelines, how do we get to the guidelines? Most guidelines are developed in response to repeated requests from CPA members for more specific guidance in a particular area. And in the mid to late 1990s, there were many questions raised about e-services, and the questions that were being raised were conflicting in their direction. There were those, and I would say these were the first that came to us, those who thought the provision of e-services was primarily a money grab by incompetent practitioners. There's no evidence that they would be effective. In fact, they probably would be ineffective. It's impossible to do this type of work over the internet. And they wanted CPA to declare such services unethical. Okay. And then there were those, and that included the Ethics Committee at the time, those who were concerned that the general atmosphere regarding provision of e-services did not recognize its potential and its benefits, and was discouraging its development, and wanted CPA to declare that it was not inherently unethical to provide such services. In fact, the other side of this was that it could be unethical not to provide them and not to develop them. So in 1999, CPA's Committee on Ethics responded with a previous draft called Cautions and Guidelines for Psychologists Providing Services by Telephone or Online. It never got past the committee process because it was believed that the draft had too many cautions and that it was too technology specific. So for instance, when we got to security of information, in that draft there were specific technologies that were mentioned, and it was pointed out that within 6 months those technologies may be out of date and there might be something new. And it was thought at that time, it was just dropped, it was thought at that time it was best just to let the area evolve with psychologists guided by the ethical framework of the code. However, questions coming into CPA head office and to the committee continued to flow in over the next 4 to 5 years. So asking, what does this mean with respect to this? Okay. What kind of guidance would you give me with respect to this kind of an issue in providing these kinds of services? CPA asked the committee to again consider drafting guidelines. And between 2004-2006, there were 3 drafts produced, and the current draft was approved in principle by the CPA Board of Directors in 2006. And I'm going to give you a quick overview of what we deal with in the guidelines, and you'll see a lot of overlap between the topics that we dealt with and Dr. Barnett's presentation about some of the ethical issues. First of all, the guidelines are intended only for services that require a contractual relationship, that is counseling and psychotherapy. They're not written for educational provision of educational resource information. It also is a supplement to the code. It does not repeat what's already in the code, only what's specific to e-services, and therefore needs to be used in conjunction with the code. It's not technology specific. There's no mention of specific technologies. And there are 23 guidelines arranged, again, organized around the four principles that I spoke about. So first of all, principle one, respect for the dignity of persons. And I've combined these, in the interest of time, I've combined them. And I think they're all there except one or two. There's a general expectation when obtaining informed consent in anything that the individual is informed of the nature, the risks, the benefits, the alternatives, privacy limitations, specific, but in this case it's specific to e-services. And what we do in the guideline is we specifically mention some, as examples, some of the risks and benefits and alternatives are specific to e-services. Also, we state that if the capacity to consent might be an issue, that perhaps there should be an arrangement for a face-to-face meeting, either with yourself or another healthcare provider that is local to the client, for instance, the family physician. There's also the issue of substitute decision makers and the need to verify their identity. We also talk about, rather than becoming technology specific, we talk about keeping up to date with and implementing current internet security measures. In other words, what would protect privacy most, and inform clients of what those measures are, and also to take measures to avoid imposters. And the example that we give is, in fact, the use of pseudonyms or codes or something like that that only that individual knows and uses. With respect to Principle 2, responsible caring, there's a general statement about keeping up to date with the e-service literature. If you're going to get into this, you must be up to date. You must be competent in the, not just the type of service, but all, the specific sort of target of your service, but also the method you are using with respect to the Internet. Do not deliver a service electronically that you're not competent to deliver in person. Ensure that e-service follows an adequate assessment. And if needed, the assessment could be also carried out face-to-face by yourself or another healthcare provider local to the client. And then just general, develop and follow e-service plans that are consistent with the client's needs and the limitations of e-services. The next one is a bit controversial, and it will probably be stated quite differently in the next draft. In the client record, include hard copies of online communications, and then I've put into quotes, of a material nature. At the beginning of service, obtain emergency contact information and review emergency procedures for the client. For instance, hotlines available in the client's geographic area, local emergency telephone numbers. I've seen some websites that, for instance, Canadian ones, that you click on your province and you'll actually come up with your area hotline numbers, hospital emergency numbers, etc. Inform clients of alternative communication procedures if there's a technology failure. And refer client to in-person services if needed and if available to that person. Okay. In terms of integrity in relationships, maintain appropriate boundaries with your availability. Remember the expectation that could be created that you're available 24/7, and is that, even from a clinical point of view, a good thing? Ensure that convenience of financial advantages of providing e-services do not outweigh the best interests of clients. know and respect licensing requirements. So here we come into the, you know, in Canada, 10 different licensing bodies, including the licensing requirements in the client's location. Be licensed minimally in your own jurisdiction and be licensed in the client's jurisdiction if required. Do not administer assessment measures online if doing so would compromise their security or violate copyright. And I'm now into Principle 4, Responsibility to Society. And there is a general statement in there about security of test instruments. This is how we've translated it with respect to these guidelines. And obtain liability insurance for e-service where feasible. Provide clients with relevant contact information of all appropriate certification or regulatory bodies. This is something that's expected of us within our own jurisdictions anyway, and it's an accountability protection. Be familiar with and honor relevant laws and regulations of all jurisdictions to which you provide e-services, for instance, age of consent, laws around mandatory reporting. So, there had been a great deal of consultation prior to coming up with this draft. There was also a review, an extensive review of the literature in the field, and then a review of all existing other guidelines, etc. And it was put on the CPA website in June 2006, almost 3 years ago, for the final round of consultation. Most respondents were very positive. However, the following concerns were raised by others. First of all, there is now much more of a blurring of boundaries between traditional counseling and the provision of educational programs, for example, in health psychology, dealing with chronic pain. Making some of the guidelines, it felt to these people, they believed that if the guidelines were too specific and becoming inappropriate for that clientele and likely to restrict beneficial services being developed. There was also a concern that some of the statements seemed too prescriptive. They read a little bit more like a code of conduct rather than guidelines, not allowing good judgment in some situations, which could create a problem for psychologists with their regulatory bodies. In particular, some of the words that were used in the informed consent guidelines, the issue of hard copies of email communications, and the general statement, why do we need guidelines anyway? The reference to the code should be enough. So the current status, they've remained on the CPA website as is since 2006 as a draft. They are referred to by members. Members tell us that they are very helpful to them. The CPA head office refers the media. We often have the media phoning and saying, do you have any documents or any opinions or positions on the use of the Internet for services? And we're still getting a lot of questions about when the final guidelines will be available. We're currently redrafting. We're trying to remove the prescriptive language, using some of the present content only as examples, emphasizing the importance of psychologists using good judgment, and still struggling a bit with the counseling versus the educational information issue. We're also likely to say something more about jurisdictional issues and our responsibility as a discipline to overcome the barriers that these issues bring to the development and delivery of these services. And I have an invitation. To anyone here or anyone you think might be interested, Canadian or not, to provide us with your thoughts, suggestions, expertise, wisdom regarding our next draft. As I said, the draft can be found on the CPA website, and I've given my email address here. Thank you, and please stay tuned. Thanks.